Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now joining me in studio here on Canucks Talk, he is the host of the Hockey PDO cast across the Sportsnet Radio Network. He is our pal, Dmitry Filipovich. What's going on, man?
Friday afternoon on a Thursday.
Let's go. Oh, that is actually a bummer. I have to work tomorrow, so I'm getting that dopamine hit of talking to you. But I have another segment after this, and then a whole other day of work tomorrow.
Well, this is going to get you through the week. Don't worry about it.
Maybe. We'll see. That's going to be tough. It's going to be tough not seeing you on a Friday afternoon. Oh, what am I going to do? I'm all thrown off now. All right. Let's start. We were just talking Stanley Cup with Woodley. We'll get into that in a second. But I wanted to ask your opinion about the Filip Hronek extension for the Vancouver Canucks. 8 years, 7.25. You know, we'd heard the reporting, oh, it's going to be eight. It's going to be eight. Ends up coming down, I think, probably because of the fit, right, alongside Quinn Hughes. What's your just kind of overall reaction to that deal for the Canucks?
Yeah, I feel like there was a little bit of sticker shock online from it, particularly people who maybe weren't following it all throughout the year, maybe just tune in for the playoffs and saw him struggle a little bit. I don't think that performance throughout the two rounds that Canucks played did justice to the sample of work he had put on tape along the way. I do think it was just a savvy piece of business from the Canucks' perspective of getting ahead of the market a little bit. I know that we've got a report, right, that Jacob Slavin's got his extension kind of in place. I think we've heard some reports of stuff that hasn't been announced yet but is in the works. At the same time, from the Canucks' perspective, though, like, I think we're going to see some silly money dished out, particularly for defensemen this summer. And so just avoiding getting into that business and getting their stuff done here before that market opens up, I think was smart. I think being sort of a first mover in the defense market is always good business. And in this case, I thought they probably saved themselves a few dollars compared to what I thought they might have had to pay. So
yeah, and then it comes down really to, it's a good point about where salaries could be going in this this summer and with this market. And everything we're hearing is that there's going to be some serious sticker shock when July 1st rolls around. And then I guess the question comes down to just, you know, how good the fit, we all know how good the fit was with him and Quinn Hughes. How much did he bring to the table there versus just Quinn Hughes leveling up? And kind of, can you, do you look at it and say, okay, the Canucks can relatively confidently bank on having one of the best defensive pairs in the NHL next year? Like, were they at that level for you throughout the regular season?
I think they were, especially throughout the regular season, right? Yeah. Did we get any sort of clarity through the availabilities after? I know, like, there was the whole thing about the contentious, like, him not wanting to talk to the media, but, like, nothing really came out in terms of injury, right? Yeah, but you could see that, like, he was just less willing to shoot, right? And that zapped a lot of his, I don't want to say superpower, I'm not going to put that label on him, but, like, a lot of his abilities were taken out the window, particularly in the offensive zone. So yeah, I think what we saw from them in the regular season is they were absolutely dynamite. You could play them against anyone. They could totally tilt the ice. A lot of that credit goes to Quinn Hughes. He was the best defenseman in the world this year. But we've seen that just because a guy's good doesn't mean that he should have to play with inferior players.
Sure.
And so giving him a partner who could actually kind of riff with him was a massive win. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing them do more of it in the years to come.
Do you have to be careful with a high-end complimentary player? And, I'm saying this as a guy who was pretty much hammering the table and saying a Hronek extension and a long-term one should have been this team's first priority. So I think this was mostly good business. But do you have to be careful when sort of teasing out who's responsible for that pair's elite results in doing a deal like this with a player like Hronek?
Definitely. I think it's always scary to give premium money to players who aren't premium players and premium contributors, right? And that's a very slippery slope you can get into. I think we've already seen, like, certainly he took his game, Hronek did, to a new level playing with Quinn Hughes this year after he leveled up. So this is a bit of a departure for him, but at least we've seen him be a good top four defenseman before, right? This isn't someone who just kind of came out of nowhere, was called up from the AHL, stuck next to Quinn Hughes, and all of a sudden took off. Like, I think there is proof of concept or a certain data set already in place before this year that leads you to believe that Filip Hronek is a pretty good, at least, NHL defenseman, right? So maybe it's a bit rich in that terms of things if it's not going to carry his own pair. But I think the Canucks are paying for what they've seen from those two guys, and they're sort of paying him to be Quinn Hughes' running mate. And so in that case, I like it. It makes sense, and I would expect him to keep succeeding.
With what's next for the Canucks, how would you sort of sort the priorities between Zadorov and Joshua in particular? Like, which of those two, if the Canucks could only keep one, should they prioritize?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. I mean, both guys did wonders for themselves in terms of raising their market value, right? I love Zadorov so much. Just like, like, you know.
He's the total package. It's
unbelievable entertainment value, and we are in the entertainment game here. So I'm a bit biased there. I really love him. I think Joshua's skill set was probably more valuable or more difficult to replicate. Not that you can't find guys like that the way they did Joshua in the first place, if you're looking in the right places. So I think both guys, you probably could find other options for less that could give you at least a certain percentage of what they provided. I would lean slightly Joshua just because, I mean, his value with him and Garland was so through the roof for them all year, and that was their best duo really all season. And so it would be a really tough player to replace, whereas Zadorov really came on in the postseason, but they got to that point without massive contributions from him. So I feel like they could probably piece that sort of depth defenseman together as opposed to what Joshua provided for them. So I'll lean Joshua just slightly.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the two players is obviously they have the, you know, the physicality in common, right? And just they're the types of players that GMs love, but also they elevated their role in terms of minutes in the playoffs, right? Joshua was a third line guy, ended up playing top 6 minutes. Zadorov, very much a kind of third pairing guy, ended up playing 20 minutes a night for them in the playoffs. If you had to bet on one of them kind of making that a permanent upgrade, right? Where it's like, actually, we thought Joshua was a third liner, but now we can play him in the top six, or the same thing with Zadorov, who would you have more confidence in going forward in that?
It's tough, because I can see sort of the bull and bear case for both guys, and that's why, Jamie, it's a great question by you. You're a radio professional here. I'll go Joshua with the caveat that I wouldn't necessarily expect him to replicate the goal scoring he did this year. I think that was probably a step up, and if we look back 5 years from now and say, all right, that's that kind of sticks out as his career peak as a scorer, I wouldn't be surprised to hear that. At the same time, though, I feel like his skill set, especially if you already have Garland in place, we know what that looks like, and that's going to work. Zadorov was unbelievable during the postseason run, but also we've seen throughout his career, there's peaks and valleys, right? He can be a bit chaotic on the ice. There's going to be mistakes. He's going to take dumb penalties. Stuff that will bug a coach every once in a while, whereas Joshua, like, I feel like his role is so solidified. It was a step up in the postseason, certainly, but I feel like it's much more replicable, whereas expecting Zadorov to just keep doing for 82 games what he did in the regular season, I'm not sure that's a realistic outcome.
Well, and Zadorov just has so much more of a track record in the NHL, right? And whereas Joshua, late bloomer, you know, still hasn't played 200 games. I think it becomes easier in that scenario to kind of dream on what he could do in a bigger role. All right, obviously we're talking Canucks free agency. Jake Guentzel has been the name on everyone's lips this week. Lots of reporting that they're going to be big players for him. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to get him. Other teams are going to be very interested in him as well, potentially including the Carolina Hurricanes. But in terms of a fit, right, like, they need a winger for Pettersson. We've been talking about that for a long time. Jake Guentzel, how does he fit in that role specifically for the Canucks in your eyes?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've already seen a lot of the questions we may have had. I didn't personally, but it was fair to wonder because we just hadn't seen him away from Sidney Crosby, what that would look like. We saw in Carolina, he passed the flying colors, his ability to play off the puck, how smart he is, getting into the open areas of the ice, tipping pucks, rebounds, extending plays, everything you want to see from sort of a supporting winger in that sense. So yeah, he looked phenomenal with Pettersson. I'm still a little dubious. I've seen the reporting that the Canucks are going to make a big push towards him. I just think there's going to be so much interest, and there's going to be a few teams. Like, it ultimately depends. I'm sure he wants to compete for a Stanley Cup in the next couple of years and play for meaningful games, and so that could be a potential motivator here. A team like the Chicago Blackhawks, though, can just swoop in and give him an outrageous sum of money for a couple of years to play with Connor Bedard, and he's a player who has been woefully underpaid for pretty much the entirety of his career because the Penguins immediately signed him to a team-friendly deal. And so if he just wanted to cash in for a couple of years, have fun, score a bunch of goals in relatively low-pressure environments, I wouldn't blame him. That sounds pretty fun. I would certainly sign up for that, especially if we're talking about $11-12 million range, which is something the Canucks just feasibly cannot give him. So that's kind of a complicating factor there. But yeah, of course, if he wants to take the Canucks money, you just essentially just give him whatever he wants and sign on the dotted line and figure everything out after that.
I want to switch gears and talk Stanley Cup final here because you and I have somewhat different takes.
Yeah. Do we have
Sorry?
To? Do we have to?
Yeah.
Okay.
We have to. It's so good.
Yeah.
So you and I have different takes, I think, somewhat on this. Like, I just think at the end of the day, especially going to where Knobloch's going to have last change, I just don't think the Panthers have an answer for 97. Now, they do. It's Barkov, right? And the one goal for the Edmonton Oilers in like 38, 40 minutes head-to-head, 16 versus 97. But Knobloch's going to be able to keep 97 away from Barkov on home ice, and Barkov is laying waste to Sam Bennett and company. How much pressure do you think is on the Florida Panthers here?
Yeah, we saw that in game four, right? Knobloch was able to get both McDavid and Draisaitl away from Barkov and essentially use that third line with Henrik, Brown, and Janmark to just play head-to-head against Barkov. And they had success doing so, so I imagine they're going to try to replicate that. I don't think we're necessarily differing here, because I would expect, based on what we've seen, Edmonton to win game six and force a game seven. I just think there's been a bit of a mischaracterization of this series from people who haven't really been paying attention, especially the first couple games where all the narrative was Bobrovsky's stealing these games. He's standing on his head. He's the unanimous Conn Smythe. And I just thought that was never the case. Mm-hmm. Like, he was awesome in game one, and he probably stole that game for them. Edmonton deserved to win it. Games two and three were awesome defensive efforts from Florida. They executed their game plan perfectly, and that was not a Bobrovsky masterclass by any means. So I think Florida's played pretty well in the series. Like, they've gotten the better of it at 5-on-5. They've gotten the better of it at even strength. I thought they played amazing hockey in game five, really, after they went down, partly score effects driven, but that's exactly how they want to play. So if they can replicate that type of effort, which is easier said than done on the road, but if they can, I like their chances to be competitive there, despite the fact that, you know, last time we saw this game in Edmonton in game four, it was an 8-1 result. So I see why that's fresh in people's minds, but I still feel like Florida's best game is very competitive and potentially even better than Edmonton's at even strength.
Now we've lost Drance here.
I can see Tom's lips moving, but he's on mute. Yeah.
Sorry. I've got yard work going on around the house, so I'm just trying to like make sure no one gets the lawnmowers. So I was listening to the Bill Simmons podcast yesterday, and he had a good idea, which is, you know, I was surprised as anybody.
Was it take Bronny James hostage? That's what he suggested.
No, that was not
the
idea. I mean,
that's a good
idea. I'll be honest. That's like, That's absolutely in line with something that I might say is like a harebrained scheme. So I'm not going to judge him too harshly for that. No, the idea that he had that I thought was good was the idea that you should have a first and second team all playoffs. Okay. For the NBA. He wasn't talking about the NHL, really. He was, aside from making fun of the Conn Smythe. But if we were to do that for the NHL, okay, first team, and you got to go left wing, right wing. Okay, who's your first team all playoffs, Dim, from what we've seen so far?
Oh, man.
Oh, we can build this together.
I'm thinking centers right now.
Off the top?
Yeah.
It's Connor McDavid.
Yeah.
It's the center.
Yes, but the wingers, I feel like, is much more open for debate. In fact, no one has necessarily really stood out that dramatically. Like,
well, it's got to be Hyman, right?
Hyman's been phenomenal. Yeah, even though he hasn't scored that much in the Stanley Cup final, I think certainly his totality of work is right up there, because the Panthers wingers, right, you'd expect, all right, they got to this point, it will be Tkachuk, Verhaeghe, Reinhart. They've all been relatively quiet compared to their standards, right? It's been a lot driven by the defense and the centers. And so the other wing on that top line is actually, I think, very up for debate, and there's no real kind of locks.
And then is it Forsling Bouchard on the blue line as a pairing?
Yes.
I think it probably has to be, right? Yeah.
So I think that part's easy.
It's just left wing. That we're and I guess goal.
Well, the goals. No, absolutely not. The goal is either Shesterkin or Swayman.
I agree.
Right.
I think it's Shesterkin.
This Bobrovsky nonsense needs to stop. not you, Jamie, in particular, but I just feel like this narrative has gone so out of control. He has a 9.06 save percentage this postseason. What are we talking about? Like,
he has a lower save percentage in the final than Stuart Skinner.
Significantly.
It was really high there for a second.
And that
though.
Team plays defense better than anybody else.
They were
the
best defensive team in the world this season.
What are we talking about?
Yeah. I know. It's absolute nonsense. People have just been swooping in and being like, playoff Bob. And that's not a thing. That's a random made up thing from last year.
People desperately want to rehabilitate his contract. And I don't get it. It's like he's been above average once since he signed this deal. And then he's had, two strong playoff runs. Like that's fine, but it's not worth $10 million.
He was not even the best goalie on his team this season. Anthony Stolar has outplayed him on a per game basis. And he got a Vezina finalist bid. Like, I don't understand where this is coming from. It's absolutely mind-boggling.
No, me neither.
But, yeah, I think it's Shesterkin just because he made it to the conference finals. At least Swayman lost in round two, so it's tough.
So we're looking for one winger.
Yes.
Is what we're looking for here, or a left winger specifically. I kind of think it's got to be Matthew Tkachuk, even though, you look and saying, he's playing below his standards, and that's fair. He's still at a point per game, and I don't know that anyone has done better than him to deserve a spot. Certainly that was eliminated before this series. Jason Robertson went so long without a goal. Yep. You know what I mean? There's no one else who really stands out.
Right. And also his peak game, the one we saw from him in game five, right? He's directly responsible for all three goals. He's creating so much from behind the net. He's just, when he's on like that, he's unbelievable. It's unfortunately for the Panthers has not happened that frequently in the Stanley Cup final. But man, that version of him is by far the best winger available here. So yeah, I think that's a good call.
I still think he needs to be on it. Okay, now can we go one layer further and collaboratively come up with the second team?
Yeah. I think Barkov clearly second line center, right?
Sure. Although
do you have any pause about Wyatt Johnston?
Or Draisaitl?
Wow.
Draisaitl's got 30 points.
I know. But he's been tough this series. Okay. I mean, he's clearly hurt.
Yeah.
So, I think that context applies. But, yeah, I mean, he has not been anywhere near his peaks. The version we got from him in round one against LA was the best player in the world. It's just been a bit of a period of time since we've seen that.
I also think we need to just, contextualize the Oilers' leading scorers appropriately. It's McDavid, okay? And then it's four guys that play with McDavid on PP1. Then the other defenseman that sees the most time with McDavid at 5-on-5 but doesn't play on the power play. Then the guy who started the playoffs on McDavid's wing before he got hurt. And then it's Dylan Holloway.
That sounds it sounds like McDavid plays a lot of great players. Is that what you're saying?
No, but he does. Ish. But
he's getting carried.
Yeah.
He's a system quarterback.
I've been a Bouchard guy. I've been a Bouchard guy for a while. But we're still at a point where Bouchard doesn't have more primary assists in the playoffs than Quinn Hughes. His shot, his ability to capitalize off that environment's been great. He's occasionally been awesome in this Stanley Cup final. But I think the clear top five defenseman in the league stuff is just people really struggling to tease out the fact that McDavid's a supernova unlike anything we've literally ever seen in the sport. And that creates opportunities for really good players who maybe aren't quite as elite as their statistical cases are, right? The Bouchard's better than Hughes people don't know puck. I'm sorry.
There's a lot of great McDavid stats throughout this postseason and in this Stanley Cup final in particular, but him having 11 points and then the second Oilers forward being at 3 is hilarious.
He's on the verge of breaking Gretzky playoff records all over the place. What, it's 13 points in the Stanley Cup final? Is it now? Gretzky did a sweep, which is hilarious. What a flex. But still, he's on the verge of breaking that record. He's what, 6 off of the all-time playoff points record in a single playoff, which the way he's going, if they play 2 more games here, is totally within reach. Is there any debate about the Conn Smythe left for you? Because I don't really think there is.
No.
For me.
I was going to say,
I don't know what Barkov would have to do in a Game 6 victory to take it from McDavid. He'd have to have a hat trick.
If it was a definitive shutting the door.
Yeah.
I think I could see that argument just because he's been so good all postseason. And like we said, for all of McDavid's excellence head-to-head in that matchup, he still hasn't really scored against him, which just speaks to how unbelievable Barkov is defensively, really like the only player in the world that could do this to him. So if he just had a dominant, emphatic offensive performance in Game 6 to win this series, I think there's a compelling case. But yeah, it's, I mean, what McDavid's doing is not being compared to his peers, it's being compared to historically great performances. And yeah, so that kind of tells you everything you need to know.
So can I get us back on the rails and fill out the second team?
Wow, this is bizarro world. Tom's like, getting us back on
up,
the rails.
Shut up, you guys. I got to do this.
So Barkov is the center. I think we're in agreement.
Yeah, Barkov's
right?
The center.
Are we putting Ryan Nugent-Hopkins on left wing?
Probably. What about Lafreniere?
I'm open to it.
He was a beast.
I'm open to it.
He was good in the East Final.
He was a beast for the Rangers.
He was pretty sick. Okay, I still think it's got
to
be.
It's just,
it's okay.
Tough
Let's
to go away.
Lafreniere.
It's tough to go away from the guys in the finals. I get it, but
yeah, I think Lafreniere. I mean, he was New York's most dangerous player in the East Final.
Yeah,
and so I think that's very. That's better than
I'm
a lot of these other guys.
That.
Yeah.
All right.
Right wing, are we going Reinhardt?
I think you probably have to.
Yeah.
But
it's a sick two-way line, by the way, that we've just built with Lafreniere. Lafreniere is like the perfect player to complement those two. It's ridiculous.
I will point out, Sam Reinhardt has only 3 more points than Brock Besser did in the playoffs. I'm just going to throw that out there, despite playing 10 more
interesting.
Games.
Interesting.
Mm.
So just throwing that. I think the gap is too big to go for a guy who was out in the second round, but like Besser is not as far off of this conversation as you might think.
I would actually love to put Besser in just because I feel like he had a career's worth of clutch playoff moments.
He really
in two
did.
Weeks.
Yep.
It's like unbelievable.
If you were
I've
doing
almost
like,
never seen a guy.
If you were doing like win probability added,
yep.
Brock Besser would be got to still be like near the top of the list in the playoffs.
Okay, I'm open to that. I'm open to putting Besser on right wing. Let's do that. So Besser, Barkov, Lafreniere, and then on defense, we've got to have Miro.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Heiskanen.
Yep.
And
thanks for clarifying. I didn't know which Miro that was.
Oh, yeah. Miro Shazam.
Daniil Miromanov.
Draft eligible.
Daniil Miromanov.
Miromanov. Oh, my God. Wow. What a pull.
All right. So
Heiskanen, anyone else?
And then one more. I don't know.
Do we go Tanev because of the gauntlet that he endured and played so well against? Like, you know, there were moments where he was up to like 100 minutes without a goal against MacKinnon and Eichel.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like we deserve to that run, even though it happened so early in the playoffs, was so outrageous that I feel like we need to give him some dap.
Yeah, I think it captures the 2024 postseason really well as well. And especially if you're telling me we're getting like a fully healthy Tanev and not one playing on a broken foot, then which is what we're doing here because we're also including Brock Besser on our list.
Yeah.
So the healthy version of these guys and they're like perfect ideal. Yeah. Give me some Tanev.
I like that. And then you guys want to go Swayman?
Yeah.
Goalie.
Don't even try to put Bobrovsky on this list. Yeah.
I should just become a huge Bobrovsky booster.
What about,
best free agent signing of all time. Just to take you guys off.
Have you guys been seeing these like Stuart Skinner stats of like him in games 4-7 and it being presented as like, a thing? As opposed to just a random collection of games, like under 10 of them.
Well, it's like, you guys almost got swept. Maybe you should have tried playing well in the first 3 games.
Yeah.
That would have been like, you're really playing with fire if you're saving it for games 4-7, man.
Well, so I do want to just ask this of Dmitry one last time, because before the playoffs, and especially before the Canucks played the Oilers, we spent so much time talking about what I called the F around and find out about the Edmonton Oilers. And it's like, to start the season the way they did, right? To go down against the Vancouver Canucks the way they did, to go down against the Stars the way they did, including that 2-0 deficit in game 4, and then to go down 3-0 in the finals and now they're battling back. I mean, what have we ever seen anything like this? Like, why is this a team that's adept at adjusting, or is this the ultimate F around and find out team?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's like the ultimate bend but don't break sort of thing, right? From that regular season, obviously game 6-7 Canucks, I'd say the game 4 against the Stars, right? Where they're down 2-0. It's a couple like catastrophic goals against right away. And you're like, oh man, they're going to go down 3-1 in this series. And then they come back from that. Yeah, I think, I don't know what it is. It might just be a matter of like, and you see it in the power play late in this series too, where eventually they're just going to break through. Like, there's just too much talent, particularly on the high end. And so we're seeing they're held off the score sheet on the power play for the first handful of games. And then towards the end, they start cobbling them together in bunches. And that speaks to me to adjustments, certainly, but also just the star players, in particular McDavid in that case, just kind of figuring it out. And just you can hold him down for a little bit, but eventually he's going to find a way to break through, and that's what he's been doing. And so, yeah, I think it's deeply impressive, probably stressful for people who are cheering for the Oilers, but still better than obviously the alternative of never figuring that out.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, from like a dramatic storytelling perspective, it's been just an unbelievable ride so far.
Well, it's just wild also with Skinner that it's not like he struggled early in the playoffs and then figured it out. It's this up and down, right? Yeah. It's like, oh, he's back. Oh, no, it's over. Oh, he's back, right? It's that on a loop.
Well, has there ever been a better encapsulation of goaltending just in general?
Yes.
Skinner
experience.
You never know what you're going to get. There's going to be three awesome games, three bad games, and they're going to happen at random intervals, and that's NHL goaltending, baby.
All right. That is our segment with Dmitry Filipovich, of course, host of the Hockey PDO cast here on Sportsnet 650 and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Dim, thanks for doing this a day early. We always appreciate it. We got one more segment left here. We will get into some free agent defenseman targets potentially for the Vancouver Canucks. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send your thoughts in.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Canucks talk vibe here on
Dom,
the show.
Dom, you know how I feel about Jazz.
Dom's trying to pin this one on producer Ben. I was kind of digging it. I
producer
like that,
Ben,
though.
This is Canucks talk, not Canucks confidential. On the QT, on the down low, and very hush hush.
I kind of love it. Blue and green shoe diaries.
It's got atmosphere for sure. It's got mood.
We're gonna have to have moody asides to the camera now. Break the fourth wall.
By the way, just a peek behind the curtain. So we have a music library that we can pick from. And I just looked over at Ben and I said, Ben, pick a genre.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes,
Smooth jazz.
1974.
Smooth jazz.
1974.
Ugh. Horrendous.
It definitely has like 70s detective show vibes.
Yeah.
The soundtrack for like, you know, they're driving
film
around.
Noir.
Yeah. Like, but more of like a TV show vibe, I'm thinking, than a true film noir vibe on that one. All right.
No, it's like a retro, like one of those, like, honestly, it reminds me of LA Confidential. It's like Jack Vincennes and Wendell Bud White, like, you know,
someone's wearing a trench
coat. Mystery
coat.
Of the Three Owls murders.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's too modern. You can tell it has too much 70s vibe for it to be like a 40s period piece. It would feel out of place in a 40s period piece.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, you have more ability to discern between formless noodling than I do.
That's correct. 100%. All right.
I hate jazz.
It is Canucks talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's all right. It's all right. We're coming to you live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line.
Blech.
Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver. Oh, my goodness. Online at DunbarLumber.com. JanPro, the leaders in commercial cleaning and janitorial. If your workplace demands a clean environment, contact JanPro for a free no obligation quote. Visit janpro.ca. All right, we had an open segment here to wrap up the show, and we've been doing the targets list, the UFA targets list, piggybacking off Euron Harmon Dial's work up at The Athletic. We've been doing it all week, and today the list is UFA targets who could bolster the blue line for the Vancouver Canucks. And I think this one is probably the most interesting in terms of just the volume of names that are out there that you could potentially make a case for and say, like, hey, I like that fit. I like that fit. It's interesting also because of the amount of work the Canucks could still have left to do on their defense, right? With now Quinn Hughes, Philip Ronick, Carson Soucy, and you'd throw Noah Juulsen in there as well. But as we talked about yesterday on the show, you'd like to slot probably at least, you know, three guys above Noah Juulsen on the depth chart if you could. So there's interesting names out there. There's also a need for the Canucks to be active in this market. And I think it's going to be really fascinating to see just in general how the UFA defense market sets up this summer. One of the things Elliot Friedman mentioned on the Jeff Merrick show today was he's hearing there could be a lot of Dmitry Orlov type deals, right, where it's short term but at a significant AAV. So that could be an interesting factor. But just in general, there's a lot of names that, as you say, could be legitimate targets for the Canucks this summer.
There are, and there's a lot of interesting names too with connections to this franchise, right? Chris Tanev sort of at the top of the list, but even Brett Pesce, right? Like Brett Pesce was drafted by Jim Rutherford in Carolina. You know, that's always like a deeper connection than people realize, right? Like when you are responsible signing off on, you know, the drafting of a player, you tend to track their career even after you depart and win back-to-back cups in Pittsburgh. You know, I guarantee you that's a player that Rutherford has tracked very closely as he's gone on to immense success at the NHL level. You've got Justin Schultz, right, where it's almost like the opposite, right, where things ended badly for Schultz in Rutherford's Penguins organization a few years ago. And I think it's notable the Canucks didn't pursue him, right, when he was an unrestricted free agent in 2022, despite the fact that, man, they had huge needs on the right side of their defense corps. Mm-hmm. Like they were way more interested in doing the Mikheyev deal than the Schultz than a deal with Schultz, for example. You know, I think in retrospect, you'd kind of wonder about that. So, you know, that's a guy who, like, I think would be an immaculate fit, right? Given this team's need for offense, you know, honestly, maybe even given his potential fit with Quinn, right? Like you want to find a defender that could push Hronek down the lineup or give Hronek an opportunity to drive his own pair. I mean, Schultz to me somewhat fits the template of what you're looking for in like a Harley, like a low-end Thomas Harley type to accompany Quinn Hughes. And yet, you know, I'd be pretty surprised if the Canucks ended up pursuing him just given the history there. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting names. Obviously, Brendan Dillon, I think, is one that we'll all be watching for in the event that the Canucks can't come to terms with Nikita Zadorov here. You know, Alexandre Carrier, a favorite of mine. Ilya Lyubushkin's a guy who played a lot of minutes for Rick Tocchet's Arizona Coyotes. So there's another interesting name with some connections. And then, you know, Joel Edmondson's a guy who Joel Edmondson and Yanni Hakanpää have been guys that I think it's Hakanpää, excuse me, who've been linked to the Canucks by Rick Dhaliwal this week. And that makes sense. I mean, those are big bodied defenders that would seem to fit the stylistic template. And, you know, Hakanpää has been a longtime favorite of mine. One thing about him is he's got like the bare minimum amount of puck moving skills or puck skills required to like actually play regular shifts in the NHL. Like he's I honestly consider him like the Mendoza line. Like the Hakanpää line in my head is what I think about when I watch defenders who I don't think have great puck skills. Like, do they at least cross that line, that threshold? Because if they do, and they're physical and they're smart and they have good feet, you know, they can play. He can, despite that, there are limitations in terms of what he can do with the puck. And then Edmondson likewise, right? I mean, you go watch that Leafs series against Boston and like all of their best shifts that ended with an Edmondson scoring chance. And it was just like, oh man, that's unfortunate. The way that this Canucks team tries to generate offense with second stick opportunities and with, you know, just like really conservative puck movement, wear guys down. Edmondson's a guy who makes me really nervous, like really nervous. I think that would be the sort of deal. The danger, I almost think there's more danger in signing guys like Edmondson who have weight, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But like might kind of silently kill you without like ever really making the big mistake. like the way that they kill you is kind of quiet as right. opposed to loud. So they keep getting minutes, but they really don't help you win. Like those are almost the players that scare me the most when I hear a team linked to them. And Edmondson for me is like, ooh, that one sends a chill down my spine. Like Brian Dumoulin last year, right? It's like, he's not going to be bad. He's just not going to help you win. And in fact, is going to do a lot of stuff quietly that hurts your chances of winning, but isn't loud enough for him to ever actually come out of the lineup in favor of, you know, a better option. In Seattle last year, a guy like Ryker Evans. Those to me are like the deals you really want to avoid. And for me, Edmondson's like the only name on this list that qualifies as like a real buyer beware. But I do think he's a buyer beware.
Yeah, if we're talking about like straight, okay, they need a physical, safe veteran defenseman to kind of offset a potential loss of Zadorov or what, I much prefer Dylan and Hakanpää over Joel Edmondson, partly for the reason you're talking about, right? Because Edmondson, I think, still has that, you know, hey, he won the cup with St. Louis. He was instrumental in Montreal going on that deep run in the bubble, right? Like, he still has that shine. So there's that kind of aura about him that jacks up the price. And then it also often turns into a role that's really hard to dislodge him from. And I don't think you have those same considerations with Brendan Dillon and Yanni Hakanpää, right? Like, you're more likely to pay normal retail price, relatively fair value for what you ultimately get from those players. And I mean, Hakanpää, like, if we're talking about, now he's a right shot guy, but like, and he's not the same offensive presence, but if you're just like, hey, we're losing a 6'7 guy, we need a really, really big guy back there to replace Nikita Zadorov, Hakanpää is the guy that's going to be kind of front of mind, I would think, for that, just in terms of raw physical presence on the blue line.
Yeah, although I would also add Dylan, because the thing about Dylan is there's some enforcer streak with Dylan, which I think is really underrated with Zadorov, right? In that, you know, he's like a master of the game within a game. And I think that really matters. I think that's something the Canucks really benefited from having in spades this year that they kind of hadn't in the past. You know, I especially when you're playing like suffocating hockey that requires just a huge level of buy-in to playing, you know, simple, to buying into team concepts, to avoiding making, you know, the home run play 8 million times a game, right? Like that's how this Canucks team had success, was it was like everyone being willing to play this system where, hey, we'll just go low to high. If the play's not there, we're not going to force passes. We're not going to force shots, right? If you're going to have that buy-in, I think it really matters to be able to win the game within a game too, because those are the sorts of things that fire guys up about the little stuff, you know, contributing in the little ways as opposed to contributing in the funnest ways, which is scoring. And of course, what the Canucks will tell you is when you do that, you also score more. But nonetheless, I think it helps to have, you know, just players that serve to remind the team based on the reaction of the crowd that, you know, some of the grimier, less glamorous parts of the game are also a big part of winning and will also get you appreciated by the home crowd. So, you know, Dylan for me would be like the one for one. If you're losing Zadorov, at least you bring in a big mean guy who will drop the gloves, who can play that game within a game and who in fact excels at it, and who has some ability to, like, you know, Dylan's probably not going marauding at the level of frequency that Zadorov is, but I mean, there is some skill to the way that he moves the puck and the way that he moves up ice. You know, he's way more than with Hakanpää. So for Hakanpää, excuse me. So for Dylan, to me, that would be like one of the guys who ranks very high on this, like, nexus where like the price point and the utility may cross in the middle. You know, Dylan feels to me like a really interesting one to keep our eye on ahead of July 1.
The other thing with Dylan is you're talking about kind of the Zadorov factor of, not that you're paying for like, hey, he's a fan favorite, but as you pointed out, like when you're playing on home ice and you can do things that get the crowd fired up, that has real utility. Like Brendan Dillon, because of the fact that he's willing to hit, he's tough, he's a local product. You've interviewed him, right? Yep. He's been on the station. He's a very likable, good talker. Like he's not going to be dropping the burns on Alberta that Nikita Zadorov was, but like Brendan Dillon has all of the characteristics of a guy that fans are going to really, really like in a hurry. You know what I mean? Local product coming home, good talker, physical hits, all of those things. So again, it's not Zadorov. Zadorov is unique in terms of like the total package like that, but even that kind of off-ice, more intangible stuff, Dylan, I think, can provide a little bit of it as well in terms of just giving the fans that player to latch onto and really cheer for on the blue line. A couple of other players I wanted to mention, because there are so many right shot options on the market this year. And, you know, we started with Brett Pesce, as you mentioned. He's kind of the high end. Two names that are really interesting to me. We've heard of Chris Tanev, of course, and if that's possible or if the Canucks are going to be able to do that. Two names that are really interesting to me that I think will probably be too expensive for the Canucks, but maybe if Gensel's not an option, maybe all of a sudden it becomes more realistic, are Dylan DeMello out of Winnipeg and Matt Roy from the LA Kings. Like, if they have the salary cap space to go spend on another top four contributor on the blue line, those are two guys that really stand out to me as guys who could either play alongside Carson Soucy, or if you wanted to try Philip Hronek in a second pairing role with Carson Soucy, you could slot up and move and play with Quinn Hughes as well.
For sure. Matt was a really good player. I mean, a really smart defensive defender with enough speed that I think you could put him with Quinn Hughes and have that be complimentary. I still think you'd probably end up wanting Hronek's offensive upside more frequently. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know that he's at that level. But, you know, that said, like, I don't know that Chris Tanev is, right? Like, I still think Tanev, if you acquired him, you'd want to play him with Soucy as opposed to with Quinn Hughes. And that's a guy who we've seen work with Quinn Hughes. So, you know, I think it's a pretty high bar. Like, one thing I'd note is I think it's a pretty high bar. I think you have to have a pretty high level of, like, puck-moving offensive acumen to fit that Harley Taves role that Hronek, you know, so perfectly did over the course of this past season. I don't know that there's anyone else on the list, frankly, other than Schultz, who I don't expect the Canucks to pursue, who I'd even look at. Well, I guess Pesce and Schultz, who I'd look at as like reasonable options to give Hronek his own pair. But I do, I would view those guys as real options. And I do think Tanev and Matt Wall would at least give you the flexibility to consider it pretty seriously.
Well,
right? Value there.
You'd have the flexibility to be situational with it, I think, right? In a way like that, I think more than anything is why we'd never really saw Hronek away from Hughes for long stretches this year, is because your next right shot defenseman was Tyler Myers. And, you know, that's never really been a clean fit necessarily, Tyler Myers playing with Quinn Hughes. Right. So it was partly because they were so good together, Hronek and Hughes, like you didn't want to split them up, and partly because there wasn't really a clean fit if you were going to split them up. So I think, like, again, in a world where you were able to land one of DeMello or Roy, and I'm pretty sure it is Roy, by the way, I know you and I have been saying it differently on the show back and forth, but I'm just going to say, I do think it's Matt Roy anyways. But you have that, and at least you have the option of, okay, can we split Hronek up from Hughes, depending on the game situation, depending on who's going. I think it gives you more flexibility, certainly than you had this year, if you were able to land one of those players. The only reason I say anything is just because no, I check it all the time. Are you kidding me? It's just because I feel like it's less distracting than us saying the different thing all the time.
It's Nick Waugh.
There you go.
In Vegas.
Matt Roy.
My one of my all-time favorites. And Matt Roy in L.A.
No, I didn't mean to call.
Maybe they should play together.
I didn't mean. Can you imagine? The Waugh-Roy pairing? Fantastic.
Yeah, well, so, no, I'm a big fan. I'm a longtime fan of him. I'm a longtime fan of Sean Walker, right? I mean, I loved seeing him bounce back. It's going to be interesting to see exactly what LA does here. I wonder if clearing the Dubois contract makes them more likely to keep Matt Roy, because
I would think
that has been such a clean fit for them.
I think that's got to be part of it, right? Is that it gives them the ability to be more aggressive retaining him. Like, obviously you want to clear Dubois just anyways because of how he played for you. But I think specifically if you're like, okay, where can we spend that $3 million going into next season? Matt Roy has got to be at the top of the list for you.
He should be. Yeah, he should be. I mean, it's that plus whatever you're going to have to pay to Byfield this summer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I don't think you want to bridge Byfield, although I do think with the way that they're set up, the length of years remaining on Deneau and Kopitar, and sort of the obligation I'm sure that organization feels to try and give Doughty and Kopitar another kick at the can. I think a bridge would be justifiable in that case, but man, if the cap does go up here and you bridge a player like that and he becomes or continues to develop into the player I think he is, it's a risk I'd carve the Canucks for, I'll tell you that much. So I guess they probably should just go long.
He feels like one of the classic players where if you go long term, you are going to be over the moon about the contract in a few years. If you're able to get him for seven, yeah, 8 years, it feels like it's going to do nothing but age incredibly, incredibly well for Quinton Byfield. On the topic of UFA defensemen, this text came in. Dhaliwal also mentioned Alexander Carrier, who was excellent for Nashville in the playoffs, and the Canucks got a firsthand look at that, of course, in the round. I don't know if you thought so, but I mean,
I like Carrier as a player
a lot.
Me too, but I didn't think he was great in that series.
That's fair. That's kind of beside the overall point, though.
Yeah, I mean, he was tasked with something pretty difficult, right? Like, I think he was the, if memory serves, and I'm going to fact check it as I talk here, but if memory serves, he played a really significant, difficult role for the Predators throughout that series. Like, I think he was the Predators defenseman that spent the most head-to-head ice time against JT Miller. So, you know, that's not exactly like an easy assignment. Yeah, he did. So, but yeah, I mean, I guess it's not as bad as I remembered it. Yeah, the Canucks didn't score a goal. Wow.
There you go.
Canucks didn't score a five-on-five goal. Canucks didn't score a 5-on-5 goal in 50 minutes with Miller versus Carrier head-to-head. That's wild. In my head, I just remembered all these games where Miller and Besser were stacking heavy shifts on top of one another. But I guess the Canucks were struggling to finish so frequently in that series that the Vancouver actually didn't do any damage in those minutes. I guess it's because it wasn't at 6-on-5.
Yeah, exactly. Carrier, the interesting thing with him is he plays such a heavy...
I'm back on board!
He plays such a heavy physical game, but he's not big, right? And I do find it an interesting test case for, like, how much you need to have both for the Canucks to be interested versus the energy, the physicality, the meanness, the grit. Is that enough for them to be really on board and really aggressive about pursuing a player like Alexander Carrier? Because to me, I see the benefit of the size, right? And especially when you stack the big players like Susi Myers and Zadorov all in the same blue line. But man, I'm willing to bend a lot if somebody's as tough and consistently physical as Carrier is. The size becomes much less of a consideration for me then when you have a player like that with that mentality.
Well, and he can help get you moving, right? I mean, he's not a dynamic puck mover, but he's an able puck mover. No, I like Carrier a lot. And again, Carrier, Susi sounds good to me, right? Like, I think finding that second pair righty, you know, I don't think you'll ever play Carrier with Hughes. So that's one thing you have to consider.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think finding that second pair righty makes some sense. I really do think size is going to play a big role in how Vancouver fleshes out those other pairs. I'd be surprised if Carrier was a significant consideration at the end of the day, especially given the interest I'm sure he'll have from other suitors.
From other teams, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Like, if you were able to do Myers and you sign Brendan Dillon, it feels to me like you're shoring up your size a lot, right? And then if you had space left over for a Carrier, that feels like a situation where you should be willing to bend a little bit. But I understand. Also, they've got a blueprint that was very, very successful for them last year. I understand why they would be trying to capture as much of that as possible. But, like, you have your principles, but you got to be able to be flexible as well when opportunities present themselves.
Yeah. Well, and if you're able to get, say, Myers and Dillon done at $5 million combined or $6 million combined, like,
yep,
that does put you in a good spot to potentially take a big swing on a Teravainen or Gensel type in free agency and still have the space required to, you know, go about bringing in, I don't know about a Carrier level player, but another,
sure,
$1.5-2 million guy potentially, to push Noah Juulsen sort of into that 7 role, Friedman into that 8 role, and then I do think you're in pretty good shape.
That's kind of the, if they could pull that off, right, and Juulsen 6, Friedman 7 and guys you feel good about above that, that would be kind of the ideal outcome for the Canucks blue line going into this summer. We'll wrap up the show there. Big shout out to Kevin Woodley and Dmitry Filipovich for coming in studio with us today. Drancer is off tomorrow. I'll be on the air with Randeep Janda, another Stanley Cup final game day, so we'll tee that up and continue to look ahead to the Canucks offseason. Drancer, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed, we'll find a way to get you in studio on Monday. It's draft week already next week, so lots going on the show next week. Thanks for listening. We're back.
Sounds like a lot of walking.
Yeah, don't focus on that. Focus on the positive. Come on, you'll be fine. You'll feel fine. Don't worry.
Yeah,
we'll be back tomorrow. Canucks talk here on Sportsnet 650.